I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Jack Whitehall is back on the road 15 years after he started his stand-up career back at the Edinburgh Fringe. I hope I've done the maths right as well. He'll set me right in a minute. Don't say anything yet. He's been very busy in the interim, selling out arenas across the globe, writing and starring in award-winning TV series like Fresh Meat, Bad Education, and his widely celebrated hit Netflix show Travels with My Father. Also in recent years, he's even broken down the gates of La La Land, starring alongside Dwayne Johnson and Emily Blunt in Disney's Jungle Cruise and in Clifford the Big Red Dog for Paramount. And now, as I said, Jack's back on the stage, touring the UK with his highly anticipated live show, Jack Whitehall, Settle Down. And he joins me now, I'm delighted to say, here in the studio. And you look relatively unscathed, Jack, but I know you've had a run-in with Vanessa Feltz. You've probably got a bit of PTSD. Do you want to offload at all?
I'm still reeling from that, yeah. I started waxing lyrical about how much of a fan I was of Vanessa Feltz as a broadcaster, and then all of a sudden she appeared on This Morning, and before I knew it, she was straddling me on the sofa. She was also, for some reason,
Breakfast television as well, wasn't it?
I think she was on a limo bike off to her next engagement, and she turned the limo bike around because she'd heard that I was on the show, returned to the studio, and then crashed my interview, but was still wearing the helmet and jacket from her limo bike.
Did you fear, straddling me in a helmet. Did you fear for a moment for your life? I mean, it's not every day.
It all flashed before me. Yeah, that entire, like, you know, biog that you just read out there, that was flashing before my very eyes as Vanessa Feltz was chucking her leg over me.
Well, that's good, because yeah, you don't get to say that every day. That's very good, because it'll all be fresh in your mind
exactly,
to unravel with me. Obviously, you were there to, and are here, I'm sure, just for the pleasure of my company, obviously, but also to promote your new UK tour, Settle Down. And in it, and it's not exactly what I imagine to be great sort of fecund territory for comedy gold, the subject of growing up,
yeah.
I think, and maturing.
I think so. Yeah, well, I guess the comedy comes from my sort of reluctant attempts to do so and my struggles to become a grown-up and live up to the expectations of a lot of my peer group that have maybe settled down and are living that life already. And I think, you know, there's a lot of stories and anecdotes as well about, like, my miscreant past and how I'm trying to let go of that and grow up and become a little bit more of a fully fledged adult. And I talk about, you know, the 4 years that have happened basically since I toured last, because a lot of life has happened in that time. And I've got a, you know, long-term partner and a dog and a house and very much feel like I am now settling down. So it's all about that.
So let's delve into where the laughs are there in a moment. But where from the reticence to grow up? What's so bad about it?
I don't know. I don't think there's necessarily anything bad with it. I just think I'd always, like, had myself down as being one of those people that will be perennially in arrested development and be a man-child for the rest of my life. And I, like, fully accepted that. And I was like, I always thought, I dread to think what I'm going to be like when I'm in my 50s. I've met that person and I'm like, I know I'm going to be that. But then, you know, I feel like now maybe there's hope for me and I won't be tragic at that age, and I might have got all of that out of my system now and I may be able to be a better person moving forward.
You say you've met that person, and we've all seen you on Travels with Your Father.
Yeah.
Is that the person that you're afraid you're going to turn into in your 50s? Because let's face it, we all do.
Yeah, no, there is also the looming spectre of my father and also recognizing recognizing that there are traits of his that I'm beginning to adopt, and very reluctantly feeling like there are elements of my character that are maybe similar to his that I don't necessarily want to see burgeoning. But yeah, that's, he's always there. He's always looming in the distance. And also, it's nice to be able to do this this stand-up show on my own, and to have a solo venture again, and to be out of his shadow.
To be freed
from him. The burden of Michael Whitehall.
Is that how you felt at boarding school at Marlborough when you were a kid? I mean, was there a desperation to escape from your father's from overbearing presence? He's never going to speak to me if I ever meet him, is he? I'm painting a very bad picture of him.
No, but also I'm worried about slagging him off, but this is very rare because we're on a radio station that he actually listens to, so one has to be very careful. You know, I can talk
until
the cows
Mr.
come
Whitehall.
Home about him on Talk Sport. He's never going to be tuning into that. I need to be careful what I say. I make a lot of jokes about that and have done historically, but the reality is I think actually him sending me away to boarding school was probably the best thing that could have ever happened, because he's very much a kind of less is more type of personality. And I think spending sparing amounts of time with him when I was growing up probably was able to give us the very, you know, strong relationship and bond that we've gone on to forge.
But watching the programme, he clearly has quite the strong character. Mm. And I wondered if, in a way, that gave you something to really push back against, and in a way formed your whole comedy persona. In other words, is gratitude a word you should be using, Jack Whitehall?
No, it's definitely true. And, you know, the reality is, people always ask me, like, who my sort of comedy inspiration was and what made me want to become a comedian. And the reality is it was him, like, more so than any other comedian that I'd seen on television or I heard on the radio. It was always the fact that my dad was a very, very naturally funny person. And when I was growing up, I could see how great he was when he was, you know, recounting a story and making people laugh, and it was this kind of superpower that he had, and I saw the way people connected with him when he was able to make them laugh, and I thought that's definitely something that I want to do. And you know, he's also a very hard, tough, and it remains a very tough crowd, and you know, for me, making him laugh growing up was always like a great challenge, but when
some
I was able
Everest
to crack
of youth.
Him I was like, oh, that's the best feeling in the world. So yeah, for both of those reasons, he was very important in the kind of like formulation of me as a comedian.
I mentioned that you went to Marlborough College, and you've talked in the past about kind of the difficulty of breaking into the comedy business as the recipient of great privilege and you know, coming from not really what you imagined to be the kind of funniest, most humour-worthy of backgrounds. How did you actually get the courage to think, I can do this despite the handicap of being a public school boy?
Well, I think honestly, at the beginning, I saw it as that, and I saw it as something that would be an impediment to I mean, obviously not opportunity necessarily, but having an audience engage with you and being able to be a comedian from a position of like low status, like seemingly as a, you know, privileged public schoolboy didn't feel like a great angle as a comedian. And I was so worried that the minute I opened my mouth on stage that everyone in the audience would hate me and it would be an uphill struggle from there. And so for years I kind of tried to mask it and affected a kind of Mockney accent and did like thinly veiled personas and character comedy and deadpan one-liners and anything I could to get away from actually having to be myself on stage, and eventually realized that actually maybe the answer was to just try and own it and send it up a bit and you know, self-deprecate and use it as my kind of, you know, unique selling point. And the minute I did that, I suddenly unlocked my comic voice and was able to create a slightly more distinctive persona on you know, the stand-up circuit as this kind of like foppish idiotic man baby and that became my act, basically. So yeah, it was strangely the thing that I was sort of trying to get away from that actually was the key to sort of finding some success as a stand-up.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You've mentioned the man baby phrase a couple of times, and of course, most of your successful comedy has been based around that whole idea of immaturity and you know, youthful rebellion and so on. Do you worry about now tackling growing up and maturity and the sort of, you know, I mean, what your audience is going to make of it? I remember going to see Billy Connolly at the what was then called the Hammersmith Odeon.
Yeah.
And he'd only recently, I think maybe a couple of years before, and he'd gone to live in LA.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was the big yin, Glasgow, yeah. Pubs, tough, you know. Yeah. And he was up on stage telling jokes about, like, nannies and limousines. And it was a really difficult night. Like, yeah, I don't think it really worked very well. I think he sort of managed, obviously, because he's a comedy genius, you know, he managed to pull it around in the end. But, you know, you felt like, you know, tenderhooks.
Yeah.
So do you think your audience has grown up with you, or might they be really disappointed that you've left them behind?
I've always said I'm so lucky, because for a lot of comedians that become successful, that's one of the hardest things, is if you've come from a background like Billy Connolly, or you're an everyman comedian like Peter Kay or John Bishop, it must get quite hard when suddenly you're living quite a surreal life and you've still got to go out on stage with your audience and do relatable material. And I've always said that I'm very lucky, because my life was never relatable. And I always had this ridiculous, like, plummy existence. And, you know, I've never had to go through that, like, difficult transition of suddenly doing stories that aren't relatable, because they were just never relatable in the first place.
Use that as a superpower.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think they expect it. But the American stuff as well, I think, you know, there is obviously a degree of, like, having to write about what's happening in your life, because that's always going to be the source of material, is the stuff that's happening in your, you know, your day-to-day life. And the reality is, a lot of my life now is spent working, and I live, you know, I spend quite a lot of time in America, but I like to feel like when I come back here, most of my observations of America are coming from the perspective of a Brit out there that finds it, like, maddening at times. And I think that's again, like, what's unlocked, you know, for me being able to talk about that on stage, is that I'm not coming back and going, oh, it's amazing out there. I'm coming and going, these people are ridiculous, let me tell you about it. And so whenever I talk about, like, Los Angeles or touring in America, all of the stories are very much at the expense of our American cousins, and that tends to go down quite well when you're playing Milton Keynes or wherever I am.
It's like they say in Tropic Thunder, isn't it? You can't go full. So how will we know when you've gone too far? I want to move on to America in a moment and then your observations about it. But first of all, you have alluded to the fact that we have many of our audience, and we welcome them and embrace them, are mature.
Yes.
Like your dad.
Yeah.
And I wonder what you have highlighted or discovered to be amusing about growing up.
Growing up, I mean,
or maturing. Like, what are the good things? We're all sitting here waiting. We're all mature, and we want to know from you, Jack. I mean, what's great about it?
I mean,
commitment
and responsibility, I think, were mainly the things that I was probably terrified of, that feel like quite grown up concepts. And there are things that I've, you know, committed to that I've actually gone, oh, this is making my life far more fulfilled. My relationship being one such example, but also, you know, she talked me into getting a dog, and I was like, this is, you know, we talked about how maybe having a kid, and I was like, I'm don't think I'm ready for that, so we'll do the interim step first of getting a dog, and if we can keep the dog alive, then we'll have a kid. So we got this ridiculous dog.
Why?
It looks like it came out of a Kinder Surprise. It's like, I wanted like a guard dog, and we ended up with a toy poodle. And it's this preposterous creature. And I've never been a dog person in my life, and mainly because I've, you know, probably didn't like the idea of having the responsibility of looking after an animal and having to take it for walks and, you know, to vets and groomers and all of these things. And then I've got this dog, and I'm like, oh my God, it's actually worked. It's really thawed my icy heart. And I am now obsessed with this just ridiculous yapping, crapping ball of fluff.
But haven't you just committed the cardinal sin? Because I think you're allowed to talk about your girlfriend, Roxy, in public, and you're allowed to use her as the butt of your humour, and part, a huge part of your routine, you know, exposes your day-to-day life with her, but you can't mention the dog. You just mentioned the dog.
Yeah, I know, and I mentioned the dog again. So, yeah, that's the one thing that she gets annoyed about, is if I'm disparaging about our dog. Although, you know, I do talk about Roxy quite a lot in the show, and it's amazing that she's allows me to be so kind of open and indiscreet about our relationship and our life together.
How long have you been together?
We've been together over 3 years now.
Yes, good innings with those jokes.
Exactly. Well, last night, though, I made a terrible error, because we started watching the Ed Sheeran documentary, and the whole first episode of this show is just like a love letter to his incredible wife, and it paints this amazing picture of their relationship. And she's like, and she said to me, she's like, I want to be married to Ed Sheeran. And then they show the sequence of him talking about the song and how he wrote the song Perfect about his girlfriend. And I was like, yeah, you know, it's probably better to go out with a musician. And if you go out with Ed Sheeran, you get you're his muse, and you get a song written about you called Perfect. And if you go out with me, you're my muse, and you get 10 minutes of material about our sex life.
With your parents watching, which I think happened the other day, didn't it?
Well, they're not watching during the sex, to be clear. They watch the material about me talking about our bedroom antics.
That must have been a slightly uncomfortable gig, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a slightly uncomfortable gig, especially as it was one of those ones where you could actually see the audience. Often they're plunged into darkness, and I sometimes prefer that. But this was one where there was a little bit of spill into the auditorium, and I could see the whites of everyone's eyes. And then I picked out her aunt, who was looking up at me expectantly as I launched into a routine about her niece, and then aborted it very rapidly as I realised what I was about to say.
Do you request that? Keep them dark.
Keep them dark.
I don't want to see them.
Well, yeah, if I'm performing in Essex from now on, it will be keep them in the dark.
Next Saturday, I think you're kicking things off in Woking. I wondered how much has changed in terms of, you said 4 years since your last comedy tour, and how much jeopardy do you feel, and is there involved in getting on stage every night, you know, and opening your mouth? Obviously, you know, it's a routine, and but opening your mouth to sort of fill those awkward silences and say anything that falls out of it, in a world where, you know, you can be cancelled at the drop of a hat for mistakenly perhaps portraying something.
Well, it's a genuine worry, and especially when you're kind of building the hour and you're doing new material that hasn't been properly road tested, and, you know, you're working it out for yourself, and a lot of comedy is about kind of trying to push boundaries here and there, and trying to kind of shock people and you know, do some kind of like subversive material. But it's very, very difficult when you're working it through, knowing that there's people in the audience that you know, could have a camera phone, or I've like had journalists in the auditorium when I'm doing like new material nights, and that's like a terrifying thought, that you may have not like properly worded or fully formulated an idea, and you put it out there into the world, and then the following day it's in a newspaper. That's very scary. So, you know, it means even more so that there's a lot more kind of like self-editing and being a little bit more cautious about what I say on stage, just because of not only the sensitivities, but also just the fact that everyone is potentially a reporter now.
Yeah, I've been. Do you worry about the sort of notion, the whole notion of acceptable comedy? You know, I mean, it almost feels like an oxymoron.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really, to be honest, like feel like I'm not a comedian that does the. I don't know. I don't play it safe, but I'm not like there are other comedians that I think have to worry about that a lot more. I don't, for example, do a lot of politics because I just never feel like it's something that my audience
wants. You won't be cancelled for being rude about politicians.
No,
it's the only place that it's still
true.
Fair game.
But like culture wars and stuff like that, I tend to veer away from things that are that contentious and that might land me in hot water, just because I've historically found out that it's not worth the stress when it does. And I have made jokes in the past that have got me in trouble. I've had historic jokes that have got me into trouble as well, and come back to bite me, and repeats of shows that I performed 10 years ago that go on TV, and then the following morning I'm getting a call from my publicist saying, you know, there have been some Ofcom complaints about a joke that you told a decade ago. And you know, that's just the nature of things now. Like the comedy landscape has moved on like a lot in the time that I've been doing it, and I always say to myself, the one thing that I kind of, you know, can give me a sort of zen approach to it all is that the joke that will get me cancelled is probably already out there, and it's like, you know, in the depths of YouTube somewhere and may resurface at some point. So I shouldn't get too like worked up and worried about it, because there's only so much kind of self-editing that you can do.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that I think it hasn't Mock the Week just been cancelled by the BBC, or it's not going, and you sort of think, actually, it's not the programme going forwards you want to worry about, really. All those past episodes.
It's the repeat on UK TV Gold that someone's watching late at night and goes, oh my gosh, you can't say that anymore. But yeah, and I also try and like, I think to myself, I rack my brain, and I've done like a deep dive of all of my Twitter and YouTube like clips and things like that, and I've gone, I think everything's okay. I've watched old like stand-up routines and like, you know, try to edit those, but you just never know, there might be something in
but
the
but it's
chamber.
Crazy as well, because surely that's not why you entered comedy.
No.
As a career, I mean,
no, but also the other problem is when you start, you're like, you don't care about any of that. And also, you know, well, I started so young and I was learning a lot like on the job, and indeed on television. Like I got put on television far too early. Like I think I was just this sort of young, fresh, exciting face that people just thrust onto shows, and I was like absolutely out of my depth, and I hadn't fully formulated what my like comedy voice was, or what my perspective on the world was, what I wanted to make jokes about. I would punch down a lot. There would be so many things that I would watch back now and I would cringe at, and I'd be like, I wouldn't make that joke now, and I wouldn't want to make that joke now, and that's not someone that I would want to, you know, make jokes at the expense of.
We grow up.
You grow
up,
and you don't feel the need to do that. But I, you know, my a lot of that learning was done whilst the camera was recording.
Yes, but that's everyone's lives now, isn't it? I mean, that's every kid growing up. Just finally and very briefly, as the coronation is coming up this weekend, I just wanted to ask you about the occasion. I think you did a private stand-up show for the now King Charles and the Queen Consort, Camilla Parker Bowles. How did that go?
Not great. I mean, I've assumed that's why I have been NFI'd to the coronation, is because I absolutely tanked that opportunity. I was invited to Kensington Palace to perform a private gig for Charles and Camilla and all of their staff for their Christmas party. I was set up to fail. There was no stage. There was no microphone. I literally had to perform in front of all of them, like the court jester. I did a load of jokes about going to school with Kate Middleton. I referred to her in jest as the one that got away. I made some jokes about Prince Harry being very brave in Afghanistan, because obviously a ginger in that climate was, you know, really running a lot of risks. And so it was awful, all of that material, and none of it barely even raised a teeter. And then afterwards I was introduced to Charles and Camilla, and he delivered a quite good line, to be fair, in, you know, the moment where I had to bow in front of him and shake his hand, and there was all this like, you know, protocol that you have to go through, and he just went, it's not so great. I think next year we'll probably book a magician. Like, wow, that is some serious shade.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.